I'm Laura Murphy Oates, and this is The Full Story.
Well, yesterday, the federal opposition leader Anthony Albanese was on the Central Coast to announce a new federal Labor candidate for a seat there.
With the federal election on the horizon, both parties are lining up their candidates.
And I am just overwhelmed by the extraordinary candidates that we have putting themselves forward.
And in the past few weeks, Labor leader Anthony Albanese has made a series of captain's picks, including a particularly controversial candidate in the New South Wales seat of Hunter.
Rinpoche has represented Australia at 5 Olympics, and Labor believe he has the goods to retain the seat held by just 3%.
So, what do these moves say about Labor's plans for the next election? And is this selection process whereby candidates are picked to run fair? Today, a Labor revolt in the Hunter. It's Wednesday, the 29th of September. Can you tell me where you are recording from today?
I am recording from the passenger seat of my car, which is parked outside the house because of lockdown. And there you go. There's a car going past right now.
Okay. Sarah Martin is senior political correspondent for Guardian Australia.
It's mainly just to avoid my little people.
Can you tell us about where the seat of Hunter is and what this electorate is known for?
Well, the seat of Hunter, as I'm sure most people know, is basically around the Hunter Valley area. It covers some fairly large regional towns like Singleton and Muswellbrook and Cessnock. And it's a mixed bag of a seat. There's agriculture, there's coal mining, but there's also farming, wine grape growing. There's a big suburban chunk of the electorate as well around the Lake Macquarie area, really on the outskirts of Newcastle. So it's a mixed bag. Across the seat, about 10% of people work in the coal industry. It's a seat that's really Labor heartland. It's been held by the party for more than 100 years. Even if people aren't directly employed in the mining sector, there's a lot of people who are indirectly affected by its fortunes.
And why is the upcoming battle for Hunter and the pre-selection in this seat so important for the Labor Party?
Well, it's super important because Hunter was really emblematic of one of the key problems Labor had at the last election, and that was its failure to really connect with blue-collar workers and its traditional base. And that was one of the findings out of the party's post-mortem of the election loss. Really, the Hunter, Queensland, it was something that was seen across the country, that there was a problem with Labor's ability to connect with the working class.
So how did they fail to connect in this seat?
Well, the result in Hunter, I think, shocked Labor to its core, because this is really Labor heartland. And Pauline Hanson's One Nation Party picked up about 21% of the primary vote, and Labor saw its primary vote collapse by about 14%. And so this was almost 10% swing against the sitting member, Joel Fitzgibbon, which was a pretty shocking result for the party and led to a lot of soul searching.
It was devastating. Our brand is in trouble.
I won't stick around if the Labor Party doesn't wake up to itself.
Tell me about Joel Fitzgibbon and what he said about this result.
He blamed the result on the party creeping too far to the left. He said that he would use his term in government to try and do everything he could to turn around the party's fortunes, and he wanted to put the Labor back into the Labor Party.
Trying to take the Labor Party back to its traditional roots, back to the Labor Party I knew when I first became a member 36 years ago.
That was his core message.
And what have we seen from him since then?
Well, we've seen a lot of rabble-rousing, a lot of shit-stirring. Straight off the bat, he was talking about the party being too ambitious on climate change. He said that he thought that Labor needed to come to a settlement with the coalition on medium-term emissions reduction targets to try and neutralise the issue of climate change for the party, because he believed that was the key issue that was killing the men's working-class seats, and particularly where coal mining was a big employer. And then that culminated last November in him resigning from Shadow Cabinet. Then earlier this year...
Joel! Why are you quitting?
Good morning, team. It's always a difficult decision, I'm sure, Nat, but I'm very comfortable with it. I will not be a candidate at the next federal election.
Saying he wouldn't contest the next election.
I'm very happy and satisfied. I'm very proud of my work over the course of the last 25 years, locally, nationally.
So what happened then after Fitzgibbon, who was this kind of thorn in the side of the pro-climate change policy aspect of Labor, what happened after he resigned?
Well, look, I guess attention turned pretty quickly to who would replace him in this seat, and Fitzgibbon decides to back someone whose name is Dan Repicoli.
Hi, I'm Daniel Repicoli. I'm about to go compete at the 2016 Rio Olympic Games. I compete in the 10-metre air pistol for men and 50-metre pistol for men.
Here's Repicoli.
What do we know about Dan Repicoli at the time of this announcement?
Everyone's on the edge of their seat.
Well, not a lot. We know that he's a professional shooter. He's actually a 5-time Olympian who competed at the Tokyo Olympics earlier this year.
And how sweet is it to win gold at a home games?
It's amazing. To win gold in front of my wife, my beautiful wife, my two beautiful kids and all our family, it's fantastic.
And Labor believe he has the goods to retain the seat held by just 3%.
He's a coal miner and a union member from the town of Cessnock, which is the biggest town in the electorate.
I've worked in mining for the last 7 years. Mining means so much to my family. It puts food on our table and it gives me the freedom to spend the time, the quality time I need to with my lovely girls.
So Joel Fitzgibbon immediately sets about spruiking him as a great candidate. But we also know that he only joined the Labor Party a few weeks ago, which raises some eyebrows.
Right, so Joel Fitzgibbon throws his weight behind this candidate. Does anyone else?
Well, Anthony Albanese.
I think Daniel Repicoli will be an outstanding candidate for Hunter.
He comes out and says he will also be backing Repicoli.
He's represented our country 5 times at Olympic Games and at multiple Commonwealth Games, including winning medals representing Australia. He's putting himself forward now to represent his community in the Hunter Valley, in our national parliament.
He announced the party would open nominations for key seats to get candidates in the field ahead of the election. But he said for Hunter and Fowler, which of course is the seat where Christina Keneally has also been controversially selected to run, those 2 seats would be determined, if necessary, by the national executive. And he makes clear at this point that he's going to make sure that the national executive of the Labor Party endorses Repicoli, even if there are other candidates interested in running for the seat. In those lines, that's when Albanese made it clear that this was going to be a captain's pick.
Right, so we've got 2 quite talked about captain's picks here. I'm wondering if you can break down a little bit about how this pre-selection works. I mean, is it normal for the leader of the party to kind of swoop in and decide who runs in any given seat?
Well, I would just say there is nothing normal about how the Labor Party pre-selects candidates, and there's different rules in different states, and even in certain seats, there's a factional divide. Some seats are right seats, some seats are left seats, some seats are rank and file ballots. It can get very, very complicated. Obviously, ideally, particularly if you're trying to represent the values of representative democracy and the values of a democratic party, you would have a rank and file ballot, but certainly that is not always the case. And for these 2 seats for this election, that's certainly not the case.
What do you mean by rank and file ballot? I mean, what does this look like when more people get a say?
So basically you ask, you know, people who are politically active, who join up to be members of the party, they join their local branch, they get a vote. That's the alternative.
So that's not the process that's kind of playing out in the seat of Hunter. How do people feel about this captain's pick?
Well, people are completely enraged by this decision. They're absolutely furious and really, really quite impassioned views from people in this electorate. And someone sent me the page of sort of letters to the editor from the Newcastle Herald, and a lot of people are deeply upset by this. They say that the local branch members have not had a say in who represented them since way back in 1984 when Joel Fitzgibbon's father, Eric, won the rank and file pre-selection. So Joel's father, Eric, held the seat for 12 years and then Joel was effectively gifted the seat. You know, this was a really seen as an opportunity to get some fresh blood to represent the seat. And it's not something that comes up very often, a position in Parliament. And so naturally, people who have been involved in the party for a very long time are very keen to either put their hands up or have a say in who's going to take over from the outgoing MP.
Right, so some are saying, hey, we would like a say in who represents us. Who would they like to represent them? Are there other kind of strong candidates that they have put forward?
There's been a number of candidates who have expressed interest in running for the seat of Hunter. As you would expect, it's a prize seat for the Labor Party and there's going to be a lot of interest. So there's a former Cessnock councillor, Morgan Campbell, who's interested. There's a woman called Emily Suval, who is a Cessnock nurse. And just side note, her husband used to work for Joel. Mm. There's a local barrister called Stephen Ryan who's interested. So, yes, there would have been a pool of local candidates who'd be interested in putting their hands up and putting themselves before branch members and asking branch members to decide who they thought would be best to represent them. So, you know, the calculation of Fitzgibbon and Albanese is that they don't believe that those candidates have sufficient profile to be able to claw back some of the votes that it needs to claw back. And that's why they've landed on Repicoli. So despite the decision angering locals, clearly the party hierarchy thinks that someone with a bit of star power like Repicoli is their best bet.
Have we learned more about Repicoli since then?
Yes, we have. So last week was a very eventful week. At the start of the week, everyone was kind of looking forward to this big national executive meeting, which was scheduled for Friday. And it was assumed that at this meeting, Repicoli's pre-selection was going to be rubber stamped. But in the days leading up to that, so first of all, on the Monday evening, there was a meeting of some right-aligned union secretaries who got together. And Bob Namva, the New South Wales General Secretary of the Labor Party, raised concerns in that meeting about potentially some of Repicoli's social media activity becoming public and that being potentially problematic and damaging both to him and the party.
What do you mean by problematic? Tell me about these social media posts.
So, look, Repicoli's Facebook account has since been deleted. I was able to have a look at some of them before they were deleted, as well as his Instagram account, which was immediately deleted. Mm. So I guess in the Facebook, there were some things on there that were problematic, such as calling India a shithole. Mm. There was some posts about the coal industry saying that anti-coal opponents could sit in the dark and freeze during winter. Mm. And then on Instagram, The Guardian was sent a trove of his Instagram activity from his previously verified site, which showed he followed a range of sexually charged sites, some of which included a North American site that published images of very 100% naked women posing with assault rifles and machine guns, you know, very artfully covering parts to comply with Instagram's nudity policy. Mm. And, you know, in some cases, artfully arranged grenades and ammunition and, you know, some fairly provocative pictures.
So he's not posting these, but you found out that he's following these sites. Is that right?
That's correct.
Right. So this is flagged and raises a concern within the party. And then you and I know some other media outlets report on it as well. What was the response when all of this became public?
Okay, so Repicoli apologised for calling India a shithole. He said he was wrong and he apologised unreservedly. He said he had very fond memories of that country and, you know, it was a stupid and offensive thing to say.
I'm a normal everyday guy that's worked my way up in the shop floor. I started my apprenticeship when I was 15 years of age and I've worked really hard to get to where I am to today, which is running an engineering workshop in the area with 60 employees from all different backgrounds in life, just like mine.
I also heard him address these specific social media comments on ABC Radio this week.
I've made some remarks on social media in the past that I'm not proud of and that I've apologised for publicly, and that doesn't compare at all, really, with some of the things that the Morrison government has been dealing with. They've had minister after minister stand down and...
Now, I guess more broadly on some of the other social media activity, he said it just showed that he wasn't groomed for politics. He said that he hadn't voted in the 2010 or 2013 federal elections because he hadn't updated his electoral roll details, and all of this showed that he was just an average bloke. Fitzgibbon also excused the remark. He said he should have found better words or could have found better words, but acknowledged that Repicoli had apologised. And he said, all of this shows that Danny Repicoli is a normal larrikin Australian. He says what he thinks.
Right, so they're saying that these fairly controversial posts are not signs of a candidate that is unfit to run, but rather of a candidate that people can relate to, that, you know, people in that electorate particularly might understand. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. You know, they would say if you're going to pick someone from who's not from the political class, who hasn't been self-censoring their social media for, you know, as long as they can remember because they think that one day they might be in parliament, then you're going to get some sort of uncensored, you know, repicoli uncut version of social media, and that's completely normal according to them. Now, that is not what people in the seat think. The ones who are upset by this say, well, this isn't good enough. Like, this is our one shot since 1984 to pre-select someone for this seat. One, we've got to get it right. And two, they argue that this needs to be someone who represents the whole electorate. And, you know, critics say this is a stereotype. We don't need a blokey bloke candidate to pick up the blokey bloke vote, I guess, is the concern, particularly when the electorate is more than just that. You've got a whole bunch of suburban and progressive voters in other parts of the seat that have a very different view on coal mining, and there's a lot of white-collar professionals, there's lots of young families, they have a completely different perspective. So I guess the concern from branch members is that this is just one part of the electorate, and perhaps his selection is too narrow cast to those types of voters.
All this happens in the lead up to this meeting where it's believed that Repicoli will be pre-selected. How does this revelation about social media play out? Is there any more response from the Labor members?
Daniel Wallace, a former secretary of Hunter Workers, which is basically represents all the affiliated unions in the region, he says that if they don't hold a rank and file ballot, he's prepared to run as an independent in protest. And there's a lot of conversation in that whether or not people are going to nominate to sort of embarrass the party, I guess, like forcing the party to overrule these local branch members who are putting their hands up to be a candidate. It's inconsequential in a way because the decision has been made, but it's taking a stand. Like, it's saying we disagree with this so vehemently that we're going to push ahead and nominate, even though we know this is a stitch up, and I'm going to pay you $750 to nominate, which is quite a lot of coin, to put my piece of paper in that says I want to nominate and, you know, overrule me. I dares you.
Yeah, a $750 protest nomination, basically.
Exactly, yeah. So despite all of this, despite the problematic social media activity becoming public, despite the uproar among the local branches, despite the candidates pushing ahead with the nomination, Daniel Wallace threatening to run as an independent, Albanese being sent angry letters, I know other MPs in New South Wales being sent angry letters, threats of resignations and so on, federal executive goes ahead and rubber stamps Repicoli's nomination. And that happened at a meeting of federal executive on Friday.
Next, what this battle for the Hunter means for the future of the Labor Party. So this kind of sounds like a party in revolt. And despite all of this, you know, Albanese kind of forges forward with this pre-selection. Has he responded to the concerns of the party members about this nomination?
Look, he certainly hasn't responded publicly. As far as I am aware, he hasn't responded privately. I know that Joel Fitzgibbon held a meeting with branch members on Friday night trying to salvage the situation and to calm the troops, but people were very, very, very angry. And I'm told there was, you know, yelling in the conversation and people resigning and Joel struggling to keep things in control. So I think there's a bit of a way to go. And Repicoli is also now trying to reach out to branch members to try and smooth things over. And, you know, obviously what is now saying he's going to introduce himself and wants people to get to know him better. And obviously he'd be worried because he needs these people on his campaign. I mean, these are the people who do the legwork for whichever political party. It's your members on the ground who do a lot of the legwork, who hand out the how to vote cards, who man booths. So it's really important they get those people back on side.
So, Sarah, we know that there was a swing against Labor and Hunter last election. I mean, is it possible that this captain's pick could lose Labor the seat of Hunter? And if that did happen, what would that say about Labor's broader strategy? heading into this election?
Well, it's a really interesting question. And I think it's fair to say it's still very unlikely that Labor would lose the seat of Hunter. It is a Labor heartland seat, and it would be absolutely devastating for the Labor Party to lose it. Hunter is one of the only real blue-collar seats left in New South Wales, and we know that there's been a gradual decline in Labor's working class base since the late 1980s. It was something that John Howard very effectively brought over to the coalition side of the tent with, you know, Howard Battlers. If they lose the Hunter, I guess that will probably suggest that this gradual decline is going to continue, and it's very difficult to reverse that trend. And what One Nation has been incredibly successful in doing is really picking up that protest vote, particularly from working class people who feel disenchanted with Labor. That's very hard to get back. So it's a real test for them to see if they can reconnect with people in this seat. And if it's enough, change the messenger, I guess.
Right. If you just put someone in the seat who aligns with the values of people there, is that enough if people have lost faith in Labor, really?
Yeah, I think so. Well, people view it cynically. I mean, it's sort of been put to me that if Daniel Repicoli is going to stand up and do a stump speech and say, we're not going to leave you behind, the coal mining worker, then people will believe him because they see him as one of them. Whether or not that's enough to win back the votes, I guess, is the question. And then it's sort of, do you do that but then lose votes the other way? Like, do you do that and then you lose some of your suburban swinging voters who aren't coal miners? Like, or are the coal miners who are disenchanted with Labor going to remain disenchanted with Labor and continue to protest by voting for One Nation or other independents? It's going to be really interesting. And also there's sort of the risk of fighting the last war. Like, that was the problem at the last election. What's going to be the defining issues of this election? It's never the same. So it's, you know, maybe they've correctly diagnosed the problem of the last election, found a candidate that is a remedy for that, and then they turn around to face an election in 2022 that has got nothing to do with the issues that were fought in 2019. And maybe he's not the right guy for that. If it's going to be about healthcare system in the middle of a pandemic, maybe the nurse would have been a good pick.
I mean, if Repicoli does win, does that show that Fitzgibbon was right, that he believes that Labor should cater to this pro-coal sentiment, this blue-collar sentiment and workers more in order to win federal elections, in order to win the seat?
I think what Joel has been saying internally is not something that the party has been unaware of. They know they made mistakes at the last election and they know they had to learn from those mistakes, and that was pretty clear from the review process, and it's been pretty clear from Albanese's approach since becoming leader. I mean, he's been very clear, even with climate change, for example, he hasn't articulated that short-term target. They have been very focused on keeping the heat and the attention on the government. They kind of have been doing what Joel has wanted them to do, but they were going to do that anyway, because obviously they didn't win the last election and there's been a lot of soul searching. So, you know, Joel might take credit for that, but I think in reality, Albanese recognised pretty early on what needed to change, regardless of Joel's sort of public agitation on those issues.
As you mentioned, this isn't the first time that Labor has kind of parachuted a captain's pick for pre-selection rather than let the members decide. We had Vietnamese-Australian lawyer Tu Le, who was pushed aside in the seat of Fowler for the high-profile candidate Christina Keneally, who doesn't actually live in the area. It seems to me that both of these seats represented a chance for new people to run for Parliament, a chance that has now been lost. I mean, what does that tell us about this process and who gets to enter politics in the current era?
They're very different circumstances. And, you know, you could sort of, I think with Fowler, with Keneally being parachuted into that seat, that was sort of to solve a factional problem in the Senate. Tu Le was pushed aside as the sort of community candidate. You could say that, well, look, maybe Daniel Repicoli, he's more of a community candidate, and they're picking someone who's from the community, who's not from the political class, who hasn't been groomed for politics. So it's sort of a different issue, I guess, in each seat. But I guess what it tells you in both cases is that really, when the rubber hits the road, it's the Labor Party machine that still decides these things. It's the upper echelons of the Labor Party that will decide in which circumstances it will allow a rank-and-file pre-selection and in which circumstances it won't.
You mentioned that, you know, this is an issue that happens with Labor. Does it also happen elsewhere in politics, for example, in the coalition?
Yes, it does, but I don't think to the same extent because the structures of the party are very different. The Labor Party, by its structure, has more central power than the Liberal Party, which is effectively a, each division has its own power structure. So it's much harder for there to be sort of a national stitch-up for pre-selections in the various seats and states. I mean, of course it happens. There are factional deals that happen with the Liberal Party, absolutely. But I think the sort of top-down approach is far more prevalent in the Labor Party.
Mm, right, because as someone who, you know, doesn't report on politics, I think I would echo the concerns of others that I'm surprised that this process exists. I mean, we have a parliament that is supposed to represent the wishes of the electorate, but there's this process that happens before people vote, which may rule people out.
Yeah, and look, I mean, ideally, if you want to have a democratic system all the way down, then you should have your pre-selections decided through a democratic process. And I think that's a very difficult one to argue against. Mm. I mean, the argument from Fitzgibbon and co. would be, well, they'll get it wrong. We know who can win this seat and we'll make that judgment accordingly. You know, their concern would be that if you put it down to a branch member vote, you probably would have got a more progressive candidate because there's more branch members in the progressive parts of the seat. So is that fair? I think if I was a branch member who'd been involved for the party for a long time, you know, you want a candidate that represents most people in your electorate, then the fairest way to do it is a rank and file ballot.
That was Sarah Martin, senior political correspondent for Guardian Australia. You can check out her reporting on this issue at theguardian.com, including her feature story, Bring Home Gold, Please. Labor Captain's Pick Faces Battle to Hold On to Hunter. We put some links to that on the Full Story page as well. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Karishma Luthria, Ellen Lee Beater, Jane Lee, and Joe Coney, who also did the sound design. Mixing by Camilla Hannon. The executive producers of Full Story are Miles Martignoni, Gabrielle Jackson, and myself, Laura Murphy-Oates. If you liked this episode, don't forget to leave a rating or a review. Okay, catch you tomorrow.